Welcome to Beat the Block, a podcast powered by BeatStars, the world's number one marketplace to buy and sell beats.
This is a show where we go deeper than the surface and talk about the best producers and artists in the game, not just about their successes, but also the blocks, dark times, mental health, and unpaid work that comes along with it.
More importantly, we find out they bounce back and turn their downsides into upsides to make a career out of doing what they love so you can too.
Get ready to experience this episode of Beat the Block. What's up, everybody? This is Ill Brown.
This is Trox.
Yo, this is Candy.
And you are here with the Beat the Block podcast. What's up, y'all? We have a special guest today. My homie, been knowing him for a while. He's been doing his thing. Would love to introduce you guys to my homie Cam One. What's up, bro? How you doing?
Yo, what's good, everyone?
What's cracking?
No doubt.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Indeed. Appreciate you for coming on, man. And it's crazy times right now, man. We are knees deep into the coronavirus pandemic. How you holding up, man? What's going on out there in Milwaukee, bro?
Oh, my God. It's crazy, man. It's crazy. Like, so much has changed. I want to say, like, this whole quarantine thing, it hasn't really been, like, a huge effect on me because I'm so used to being at home anyway. But seeing everyone else be at home is kind of odd, you know, and not being able to go hang out with friends and visit family as often as I would like to is weird. And I feel like watching the news and social media is just, it's like you're asking for bad news. It's like, it's just a shit show right now.
Yeah, man. I had to shut all that shit down, man. I'm like, yeah, man, I'm just going to stay focused on my gift, man. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's wild.
Hey, speaking of shit show, man, how you holding up with the toilet paper?
The toilet paper? I moved on to the socks. No, I'm just kidding, man. I stocked up. I had not like crazy, but just like a normal amount, you know? Like, it's just me and my girlfriend at home, so it's like we don't go through a ton.
So you was one of those ones walking down the street with like 10 packs of toilet paper?
He's not a hoarder.
No, man. People were going crazy. They were stocking up like way over the top. But no, we just bought like a little 6-pack and we're good.
Y'all good to go. That's what's up.
Yeah, it's crazy times, man. Like,
yeah, it's insane
to see somebody walking down the street with a big ass sack of toilet paper and a damn mask on is just,
it's ridiculous.
It's a culture shock for me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, wow.
Yeah.
Hey, I heard Ralph Lauren is designing some masks though, man.
Oh, I need in.
I'm trying to cop one of those,
the luxury brand, huh?
Quarantine in style, baby. Let's dive right in, man.
Let's do it.
So I want to take it back to your adolescent years. You said that you were at this house party. First of all, what was the house party like? What was the vibe?
So I grew up going to these house parties. It was like a tight, close-knit group of friends where we would just kind of hang out and just kick it, you know? And there was one night where I saw that my boy kept his laptop or his computer in his kitchen, of all places, just kind of tucked in the corner, and he had FL Studio open.
Oh, dope.
And I got curious, and I just started clicking around, and one thing led to the other. I started making beats in the middle of this house party.
So it was one of those things where it was like, you were off a couple drinks, you know what I'm saying? You were off a couple drinks, and you were
a
like...
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. I didn't mean to put the business out there.
What this is.
But you got a little drunk, and you were like, oh, there's some FL Studio. Oh, man, let me just make beat real quick. It wasn't one of those things where it's like, you've always been curious, like... Just stumbled upon it on accident.
To kind of give you like a perspective of where I was at that point in my life, I was doing graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
I was airbrushing t-shirts, so I was definitely into like artist mode.
Oh, dope.
I was painting. To be honest, probably we had probably just gotten back from painting something that night where we just ended up at the house party and maybe a little tipsy, maybe a little drunk, and you know, found the computer and got curious. And to be honest, I had no idea what making beats was. I was a fan of hip hop, right? But I was never curious as to how they were making it.
Right.
So when I saw this program, I didn't put two and two together.
What did that first beat sound like? Be as descriptive as you can.
It sounded like the FL piano with a cheesy ass kick drum and a snare. It was trash.
You tried to make a Soulja Boy type beat or something?
Yeah, and you know what? Actually, at that point, I think I made something at 140 BPM. So it was almost like trance techno. to be completely honest.
140 BPM.
It was more in that realm.
So you didn't even start out with hip hop. It was more like a no. techno beat. Oh, that's crazy.
Techno yeah, it was house. Crazy. I was definitely into like Daft Punk and like Tiesto.
Man, that's dope. Still going on with your adolescent years, you had a friend named Rolando. He was an artist you worked with a lot. Tell me about him.
So he was kind of like in the same lane as me, definitely an artist. You know, me and him discovered graffiti at the same time. I was coming in like being a fan of like this trance and like Daft Punk, Tiesto sound, and he introduced me to Big L, to Biggie, to pretty much like real hip hop, like where I am now with my like passion for it. He introduced me to all these artists. Because of that, you know, he kind of developed the skill for like writing. We didn't really discover it until I started to make beats. When I became more confident in my sound and I started making more beats that sounded more like rap beats, I think that kind of gave him the confidence to come out and be like, yo, we should start recording some shit. And so we started working together.
Man, that's dope. Does he still kind of like propel your creative endeavors to this day? Is he still helping you out with anything?
Man, it's kind of sad to say. Like, I think after a few years, you know, we kind of like parted ways a little bit. I think he got involved with work. He's like married now. So he went about his life. I went about my life. But I still consider him a big part of my life because he helped me discover like my path. We'll like talk through IG every once in a while. But yeah, I want to consider him still a close friend.
Definitely, man. So going back to your adolescent days, at one point did you start to like sell beats?
Might have been like 21, 20. So I was selling beats because I was uploading them to like SoundCloud, and I would have like a batch of beats like in a folder, and I would try to promote it on Facebook.
Oh, dope.
I'll say, you know, I got this batch of beats that's fresh, it's ready, it's new. If anyone's interested, send me like a message or an email. And that's pretty much how I started.
So when you sold that first beat, how did that feel? Like, describe your feeling when you sold that first beat. Like, oh, I can actually do this.
It was crazy because before that, I was spending like days and like I was dedicating so much time to making music, not necessarily for the money, but just because I loved it. You know, I became obsessed with it. So when I sold that first beat, I was like, damn, so lunch is paid for. Like, I can go to McDonald's now. I can go get food. I can go get a T-shirt. I don't know. Like, it wasn't crazy money. It was just like an extra $50, $20, $15 that I was able to spend.
Definitely, man. It's a great feeling, man.
It's an amazing feeling,
now,
yeah.
Going to your samples, like, I listen to them, and I can't help but think of, it reminds me of like an Italian soundtrack of some sort. Like, like as far as beats and like your compositions go, like who are your influences?
If I can name some influences for the compositions, like the whole sample side, I would say Rick Wakeman.
Yeah.
I would hunt down his records. And then there's this Japanese composer. His name is Yuki Nakashima. He was known to play keyboards for like heavy metal bands. But he released a few albums under his own name. And his work is just insane. Heavy keyboards, a lot of synthesizers, very melodic, but like it had like that sound of just like that evil sound, you know? Where it was beautiful music, but you throw some drums on it and it just becomes like this evil soundscape made for rap.
It just turns into straight murder music.
Grimy shit, yeah,
it's
just, yeah.
It's the shit that you and I grew up on. Like
exactly.
You said, you grew up on Big L.
Like those ALC samples, yeah.
Nah, I love that shit, man. But as far as beats go, like when you started making beats, like who, like, were you studying?
The Alchemist, 100%. He was like, he's probably like top of my list. J Dilla, Madlib, Timbaland. I think like all the GOATs, like all the go-tos, right? But if I had to pick like just one, I would have to say Dilla. Because when I found out about Dilla, that's when I really started to take production serious. That's when I started to like really dive in and be like, he's sampling Tomita. Like he's sampling like prog. And before that, I was looking for like soul samples, which I still love. And I still look for that stuff. But because of him, I was able to look at the other shelves, like the prog rock, like the synth library stuff. And the stuff that was more obscure, because there's a lot of gems in those records, and I had no idea that that even existed before him.
I think we both kind of had the same path, man. Like, and it was what he was doing to them as well.
100%.
Yeah, super creative. So your sample packs, super dope. The fact that you even decided to take that route is what really set you apart. Even though it's really popular now, it's just, you know, that approach to it opens up a lot of doors for producers. But I know you have a beat battle background. You won the Remy Martin Producer Series in 2017, right?
Yes.
Did you do any other showcases leading up to that, or?
As far as beat battles, my boy Lex Luthor, he put me on to it's called the Milltown Beatdown, which was hosted here in Milwaukee. And it was going for like 10 years. And I joined in 2012. And that was my first experience being a part of a beat battle. And I actually ended up winning that year. So I did that. And then the year, the following battle, I win. I lost, but it was also an amazing experience. I think doing those battles gave me confidence in my work.
Yeah.
And it, you know, kind of gave me the confidence to keep making music, and that seeing the reaction from people was really addicting.
I think it is a huge confidence builder, and it also puts you like involved with the community of producers. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things that we struggle with is like confidence, knowing that your work is good.
Yeah.
I know it's probably countless hours that we all sit here and we're like, is this good? Is it not? Is this trash? So. Yeah. Having that big battle experience is good. Do you have a go-to move that you typically did when you were in a battle? Were you like one of those people that performed your beats or just laid back, chill?
I'm trying to like put myself back in 2012. I must have been like still. I wasn't moving. I was nervous. I was nervous. And it wasn't until maybe because also too, you know, they had open bar. So, you know, I had like a beer, like I had maybe two beers in me, and it kind of loosened me up a little bit where I can like not be so awkward on stage.
Right.
Because like a lot of the times your beat might not be that amazing, but if you are confident in your sound and you're moving around and you get the crowd on your side, you'd be surprised how far you can go.
Absolutely. That's definitely what matters.
Man, it's funny what an open bar does.
Man, let's dig a little deeper in, man. So you had a gig at a dope shoe store, man. How was that job, man, and how long did you do it, and what made you decide to be like, okay, that's enough?
So I worked at a store called Moda 3, which is in the Third Ward neighborhood of Milwaukee. That's kind of like the hip area. I actually started working there because before that I was working at a place called Sellers where I was helping do design work for toilet paper and shop towels for like their packaging. I was a production artist, and it wasn't a very glamorous job. I was just kind of working with Photoshop files and Illustrator files, just laying out text. And though it was a great paying job, I had to leave. It was exhausting, and it was kind of sucking the soul out of me a little bit because I was there 8 hours, and I'd go home and almost losing motivation to even work on music at the end of the day. So I noticed that. I left, and luckily I was able to transition right into this job at Moda. And, you know, the environment there, the vibe there was amazing because they sold amazing clothes, amazing shoes. The owners were amazing people. And it was just a really dope experience where I was able to do design work to help promote the store. But it was really interesting work. So I was allowed to be creative. So having this 9-to-5 that allowed me to kind of express myself and do what I love, but then still go home and have like that motivation to do music. So it was like a really good balance.
That's dope.
The reason it didn't last more than a year was because I think they realized that the store was going in a different direction and they wanted to throw funds at other projects and they couldn't afford to keep on a designer full time. So that was kind of like the kick in the butt to try doing freelance and to dive into working for myself.
How did you turn that into an upside as opposed to saying like, man, I just lost this job at this dope sneaker store. I may as well just take this design work and just go for it.
So being let go from that job, like that first week was kind of like, it kind of crushed my soul a little bit because I really enjoyed working there. I was kind of put in a position where like, damn, like it's either I try freelance or I go apply for a job that I know I'm going to end up hating. I decided to kind of face my fear and give myself a shot and try doing freelance. And at the time, I didn't have much money in the bank, but I had the drive and I had a copy of Photoshop installed on my computer. So I said, I'm just going to try this. And little by little, I started getting jobs. You know, people were hitting me up for like logos, for like cover art. I'm heavy in illustration. So I was doing like illustration work for like apparel and just any little thing that I could book. I was booking and I wasn't getting paid a lot, but if I was getting paid at least $50, I considered it a win.
No doubt, man. That's super dope, man. So during those times, man, you know, you getting design gigs, making $50 here, maybe more on some other jobs and stuff. What moment were you like, you know what, I want to just keep fighting and doing my thing as a freelance designer as opposed to just getting a job?
From like the design side, I think when I booked my first branding job, that was a 4K job. when I was able to charge $4K for a logo, where before that I was charging $150. I think I was doing like 30 plus logos a month to just, you know, just to cover bills and stuff and to stay afloat. But when I booked this one job, I got one job that covered me for the next 2 months. When I experienced that, that was like an eye-opening experience, because I was like, damn, I just got to find the right clients and I can probably keep doing this for forever. Before that, it was just becoming exhausting, you know, charging $100 for a logo and having to book so many just to stay afloat and barely make it. It just wasn't making sense. Being able to book that first client, like that first big project, it was just an amazing moment.
It's the light bulb moment where you're like, you know what? Maybe it's time to work smarter and not harder. You know what I mean? And
yes, yes.
Indeed, yeah. You begin to know your worth as a brand yourself, because it is indeed a moment where you're building your brand. Yep. And it's like, yo, I just did 30 logos for what the workload would have been for just one.
Right.
It's time to start seeking out, you know, better gigs, basically. You know what I'm saying? What was like the exact moment where you were like, yo, I'm going to do this full time. This is where it's at.
A lot of the win started to happen after I met my girlfriend, Ruby, because before that, I was really having a hard time kind of like staying positive, kind of being in and alone and having, you know, I'm Mexican. So my parents are, they're not the strictest Mexican parents, but, you know, they have like the mentality where they want to push their kid to go to school, you know, get a safe job. And they just want the best for their kid. And the idea of drawing pictures and making music all day doesn't translate to money in their mind. But luckily for me, they were a little bit more open-minded and allowed me to just kind of explore that and not give me that much of a hard time. But I think the type of person that I am my own worst critic, and I deal with stress, not the greatest. So anytime I would like lose a project, it would put me in a bad mood and kind of like I would start to doubt myself. And it wasn't until I met my girlfriend where she kind of like was that person that kept me going and said all the right things to keep me motivated and focused.
That is extremely dope, man. Like, there's nothing better than a good woman to help you beat the block, man. That's why we're here, man.
Yes.
Without asking directly, you know, this podcast, its primary function is to serve as a way to, you know, talk about those issues of producers and artists and creatives go through, where it's like, yo, this is really taxing on your mental health. You know what I mean? Like,
it is.
That's why we're here. And we, you know, I know it's beside the point, but we desperately wanted to provide that outlet for creatives to talk, man. And just hearing you say that, man, it's so relatable to all of us. And that's the message we really want to convey to anybody who out there listening to this podcast. Like, yo, you're not the only, hey, people with success are going through some of these very same, you know, mental blocks, creative blocks. And you know what I mean? It's so dope that, you know, creatives like ourselves are here to aid that in that process. Like, hey, we understand you're not the only one going through it. And here's something that you can do to possibly get over that hump, man.
Yo, what up, L. Brown? I'm thinking of signing up for BeatStars. What's your experience like?
Man, bro, BeatStars came through for me at a tough time, man. Of course, the industry is much different now. It gave me a platform where I didn't have to build my own website, and I was able to upload my beats and sell them and engage with the community, man. I had a crazy first month, man. Did like 4K in sales.
Wow.
And I've been a fan and a member of BeatStars ever since. Sign up on BeatStars to start making money with your beats. Go to bit.ly/beattheblock1. Again, that's bit.ly/beattheblock1. Peace.
So I got a question for you. So you were selling these sample packs on Drum Broker, and then you eventually said, hey, I'm just going to do this on my own. What led to that?
Al Coda from the Drum Broker gave me the amazing opportunity to put 2 volumes of my sample pack on his site. And he's a businessman. He looks at numbers and he's trying to run his business like efficiently and have the best vendors on his site. And at that time, I just wasn't able to live up to that standard. I wasn't selling packs. I wasn't meeting those numbers. So he asked me to leave. You know, he just said, you know, I'm going to take your packs off the site. And then, you know, if things change, I'll like bring you back on. But I just saw that as an opportunity. Okay, let me get my shit together and make my sound better. And let me try this independently. So then I ran with K1 Music Library for a while, but then I switched over to Hijo de Ramon, which is my current company now.
Explain the name, Hijo de Ramon.
Hijo de Ramon is, it translates to the son of Ramon, which is my dad's name. So I pull inspiration from my family, like the names of like the samples, like the cover art. I usually feature photos from like my dad, because my dad, I consider my dad my hero. He's a beast. He's a hard worker. My work ethic comes from him.
So when Drum Broker, when Alcota told you to leave, like how did that make you feel?
I think carrying like that negative energy on someone's decision on how they run their business, I didn't want to carry that. So I saw like the bright side of it. I saw it as him allowing me to like pursue this on my own. If he wouldn't have never let me go, Hijo de Ramon would have never happened.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, and at the time, I already had enough stress, and I didn't want to add on to it by being mad at him for running his business the way he wants to run it.
Definitely. Good way to look at it, man.
Yeah, it's so hard for, like, people to bounce back so easy after these type of letdowns, working on trying to get placements, and then you learn that projects aren't going through, and that could be your big break, and then you attempt to do something different with the sample packs, and then you get let go from that. But it's really cool that, you know, you were able to say, forget it, I'm just going to do my own thing, and kind of shift that energy instead of like letting it carry you through your career and thinking, you know, bringing in that self-doubt and all that kind of stuff that we automatically get, you know?
Yeah. And like, don't get me wrong. I mean, like, I don't want to make it seem like it was a perfect transition, that I handled it amazingly. I mean, I did my best, but I also dealt with like the self-doubt. I questioned my sound. I questioned my abilities. But I kind of had to do my best to mute that side of my brain and to see the tools that were in front of me. Instagram, Sellify, Shopify, my ability to create samples on my own. And I consider myself a machine, you know, like I have everything back in front of me. Like there's no excuses to not do it.
Yeah, so you just doubled down, made yourself better and put yourself back out there.
Yeah.
That's super dope. So tell me about your process of making samples. Like, do you come up with like a theme in the beginning, or do you just get inspired by what you hear? Like, how does that really work?
So when I start a sample pack or a sample, I'm usually coming off of listening like an album, because I'm a big record collector. So I got tons of records. So I'll probably listen to something and I'll hear something that I like. If it features like a crazy synth or like the Rhodes or a piano, I'll go to that instrument in my studio and I'll just start jamming. I'll press record. I'll just start playing a bunch of random things, and then I'll find a pocket of like chords or like a progression or like a melody, and I just build on top of that.
Just roll with it. Yeah, that's super dope. So when people started using your sample packs and you started to build that type of traction, when was the time that you realized like, this is what I'm going to stick to?
Honestly, it's crazy because when I first started seeing my samples get placed, I think so Lyle LaDuff ended up using my sample for a Quentin Miller song. I think it's called Freestyle. And that wasn't like officially like cleared through me, or like it wasn't done properly. It's probably because of me not following up and not having proper management and an attorney. So I just saw it as like, oh, dope. He's using my sample and it's out there. I wasn't really thinking about like, do I collect my royalties or like splits? I just saw it as like, it's a win. It wasn't until later where I started to learn like, damn, I need to start following up with these people to make sure that, you know, paperwork is in order. And then Key & Kenny Beats put out the song Love on Ice, and it used one of my samples. And I saw that not necessarily blow up, but it was, you know, it was one of the bigger songs on that project. And again, I failed to follow up. I didn't have an attorney or a manager, and I just saw it as like, okay, cool. My samples are being used. My samples are getting a little bit of exposure, and I just saw that as a win. Kind of like being lost on how to deal with placements, and then seeing my stuff get out there kind of convinced me to keep pursuing it, but knowing that I had to kind of figure things out as I go, like how to properly deal with clearance and to handle things the right way.
Yeah, everything seems to be like that trial and error, because it's like really nobody to hold your hand through the process.
Yeah.
So when you got those few placements, you felt that confidence. It was like a confidence booster, like, let me make more sample 100%. Packs. So that's super dope. So you ended up getting the placement on Jesus is King from that loop and that sample pack. that you did, like, what was your process with that? Did you even think that that sample that you came up with was, like, special, or were you just going through your regular machine routine?
I think with that specific sample, or when I make any sample, if it makes the pack, that means I'm, like, really proud of it, because I don't consider myself, like, a really professionally trained musician. I still struggle to, like, find chords to this day. I don't know how to read music or anything, so I usually play by ear. So when I found those chords and I found the sounds that fit well, I was excited. You know, it was a synth heavy track. I love synthesizers, and it was like the perfect sample in my mind. But I didn't think it would end up where it ended up. So the fact that it got to where it went, it completely blew my mind.
Changes the game.
Yeah, it was crazy. It still is crazy.
So what happened when you got that call? Like, how did you react?
So I moved in with my girlfriend. We found this place, and we were only in there for maybe, I think, a month. And I was in our living room, and I got the call from a friend letting me know that he spoke to the producer who got the sample to Pierre Bourne and Kanye. He said, like, I was on the phone with dude, and he told me, like, yo, you might be on the Kanye album. And, you know, when you hear someone tell you that, you're like,
yeah,
like, right.
Right.
You're not going to believe that. Like, that's just like, yeah, I need to hear from Kanye himself for me to believe it. So he told me that, and that was just kind of like the seed planted in my brain. I kept thinking about that conversation and if it held any truth. And then the person that I was sending samples to confirmed that, you know, it was moving forward in the process. He said, can you hold this specific sample for Ye? So when he sent me that message, I was like, still kind of like, hold it for Ye, like,
right,
Kanye, like, hold it for Kanye. Sure. So I ended up putting that sample to the side. I think I took that sample off of my packs, and it pretty much stayed like that for a few months. And it wasn't until before I left for LA in 2019, I got the call again from dude telling me, like, bro, you made the album. The song is called On God, and Pierre Bourne produced on it as well. And hearing all this, I think it took a while for all that to sink in.
Right.
And I remember the moment where it finally sank in was before he released the album. I was on my last few days of LA of my 2-week trip when I saw on Twitter a video of Kanye dancing to the song.
Crazy.
Like, it's like a 15-second clip, but him, like, jamming out and playing this song at one of his, you know how he was doing, like, those listening parties? Yeah. And when I saw that, I was like, oh my God. Like, we fucking made it. Like, we're here. Like, that's Kanye dancing to my sample. So, yeah, that was the moment where it hit me.
That's amazing. So, you made that sample how many years ago? Like, was it something recent?
I must have made that sample, like, early 2019, if not late 2018.
Okay.
I'll have ideas recorded, but then when it comes time to put together a pack, I'll start to finalize it.
Right.
So, it must have started with just, like, the ARPs, and then I added stuff later.
Got you. So when you removed them from your pack, that sample was already released?
Yeah. So, and again, this kind of falls into me being independent and not making that many sales.
Right.
So even though it was released publicly, 3-4 people had it, I think. So I think one producer did actually make a beat and post it on YouTube using the same sample. And there was some confusion in the beginning, like, oh, damn, did you make this beat? But it's just because he had the same sample.
Right, right.
That made its way to YouTube, unfortunately.
Tell me about that process, because I want to know. So somebody found out that another producer made the beat using the sample. How did that work out in making sure that, I mean, I know it was easy for you to say I made the sample, so.
I don't think it was really an issue, though. I think for me, it was just like, I kind of worried because this was like my first huge, huge placement, and I didn't want anything to kind of ruin it, you know, or to question whether it was my sample. At the end of the day, it didn't make a difference. It didn't cause any friction, so.
That's super dope. So, got the Ye placement. I know you were like super high off of that for a long time. How are you able to maximize that situation?
That led to a little bit more success with the sample library. I started to get more attention to that side of the business. Like, they were more interested in what I was doing. At the same time, I'm not sure if I really maximized it the way I should have, because I didn't want to come off as like I don't want to be known as just the guy that produced On God.
Right.
I was really focused on like trying to like, okay, I did this. This is amazing. Let me celebrate. But now let me get back to work and let me see what I can do next. And it was a weird transition because kind of setting that standard really high for myself, it kind of led to like a weird creative block, almost like a dark time, because you know you're riding that wave of working with one of your idols and one of your favorite artists, and you're asking yourself like, damn, how do I top that? Is this as high as I'm gonna go? Can I go higher? Like, what's next? Like, what am I, like, what can I do next to make sure I keep this momentum going? And I'm not gonna say I fell off and, you know, life's ruined, but you know, it was a weird time, because every time I sat down to work, I was like, I gotta make On God style stuff. I gotta make that quality. And when I just wouldn't make anything of that quality, I was really hard on myself. So I had to kind of step away for a little bit and just kind of reset.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult. A lot of people don't realize that if you make a hit record or if you get a large placement, even if you make a dope beat that you just came out of writer's block or something and you just came out and cranked out something amazing, then you're always chasing that same feeling or that same opportunity. I think it's like kind of natural. So what is one of the ways that you are able to like counter that, like today?
Before, I was like really obsessed with like working on music every day at every hour. But after that, I started to realize like the ability to kind of step away and recharge is amazing. Like that to me has really led to me defeating creative block. It could be as simple as going for a walk or for not making music for a full day and just doing things completely different that has nothing to do with making music. It kind of allowed me to kind of reset my brain and to come back fresh. And that has just led to, you know, I was able to crank out two packs after that, where before I was struggling to even make one piece of music.
Right. Yeah, that's crazy.
Yo, that's so dope, man. So, man, with all that being accomplished, all that being said and done, man, take us back, man. 15, 16-year-old Cam, back at the house party. Did you ever think that you would take it this far? Like Biggie said, did you think hip-hop would take it this far? You know what I'm saying? We'll take us back, man.
If you would have told me that I would be working with Rick Ross and Kanye back when I was 16, I wouldn't believe you. I would be like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. Especially with the music that I was making at 16 and 15, it just wasn't going to happen. But I'm the type of person that when I find something that I like, I get really, really obsessed with it. You know, when it comes to like my art and with my music, if like, for example, I just picked up sign painting and it was like, it's a new skill for me, but I started buying brushes, I started buying paint. I became really obsessed with learning this new skill. So when I discovered music, I treated it the same way. I started looking for sounds. I picked up crate digging. I cleaned out my mom's computer so I could install FL Studio on it. Like I did everything possible to make the learning process smooth so I can really become great at this new thing. So at 15, 16, I think I was just really focused on making my music not sound like shit.
Right. Word up, man. Well, man, you come a long way, man. But, man, what's next? What you got in the pipeline, man? What's next for Cam One?
The focus right now is just to keep on creating out sample packs, man. That's like the focus. I feel like that's working for me. I want to keep getting placements. The next goal is to start scoring. I want to work with filmmakers.
That's dope.
I feel like creating like textures and vibes. That's where I want to go next.
That's ironic. That's where I am now, man. we're definitely going to talk off the air about that for
yes,
sure.
Sir. I'm ready.
We're definitely got some opportunities, man. For all parties involved on this show.
Hey.
So
absolutely.
How about that? You know what I mean? So
that's what's up.
That's like a, you know, like the Willy Wonka ticket and shit, right? You know what I'm saying? So
go.
Got the golden ticket.
Man, we getting toward the end of the interview, man. Definitely got to let you plug your social media, man, where people can find you online. Definitely plug the website. Where can people get these amazing samples, man?
Yeah, man. So I'm going to just say my main hub right now is Instagram. So if you follow me at Kame1, CAMEONE on IG, and I have everything linked there from my sample library to my design company. It's all in the bio.
That's dope, man. That's dope. I remember when it was Kame1 Music Library, man, and the first joint I think me and Trox got our hands on was the drum fill joints.
Yo,
yep. And I still rock those.
Yeah,
man.
I still rock those too, man. Those are crazy.
Man, I remember every time I would see Trox use those fills, I'd be like, yes, they're working. Like, producers that I look up to are using my shit. It was amazing.
That's what's up.
It was
no
amazing.
No doubt, man. So just, you know, just know that you inspired us as well, man. And to this
appreciate
day,
that,
man, like even from back then, we're still banging out with some of those kits, man. And
I appreciate
we shop with the Hero Day Ramon. So it's working, man. Keep doing your thing, man.
Definitely.
So, man, appreciate your time, bro. Man, feel free to join us anytime, man.
Thank
keep
you
us
so
updated
much.
On what you got going. Hopefully everybody out there listening, this helps you beat the block. I am Ill Brown.
I'm Trox.
And I'm Candy.
And we will see you next time. Peace.
Peace.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Beat the Block. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. It helps the show a lot. See you on the next episode. Peace.